Bonk.
Dan.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. I'm glad to hear you're great.
We're a bunch of great people sitting in Pizone about to record what I hope will be a great podcast.
I hope it is, too, and I hope the folks like it. Boy, it's hard not just to jump right in sometimes.
Well, let's try to tiptoe around it.
Okay, do the volleyball set. Send something my way.
All right. When you woke up this morning, what's the first thing you thought about?
Hitman 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
And you could see Dan's thoughts on Hitman 3 or his first impressions at www.
The longest it's ever taken to give a YouTube channel. Go on. It's already the longest, and you just said www.
Period. You
Period.
Too.
It's all lowercase or uppercase. Either one will get you there. Go on.
Period com. That's com / Dan Riker.
I don't even know if that takes you there. It's like my old account, and it's my old exile name that I used in college. That I hate it when places don't let you change your names.
Now you're bound to it.
Yeah, and so it's like PSN finally let you change it, so I was finally able to change it on there. But I couldn't change it on YouTube. Or, like, there's a few platforms where I've had to use the old one.
So. Yeah, because that doesn't really give you any indication that it's you.
Yeah, and in this day and age of, you know, putting out the podcasts and the YouTubes and the Twitch streams and everything, you got to have that consolidated brand, right?
Yeah, all that tells me is that it's some college kid who likes to party and listen to the Rolling Stones.
Party? Well, I guess Mass Street was... That doesn't necessarily mean party. You've been on Mass Street.
It's a college town.
Yeah, but Mass Street, I could have been going to that bookstore that we went to and having a coffee.
Yeah, I'm sure that's where you spent a lot of time in college.
I took my textbooks to the Java Brick. To the Java Brick and did some studying on a Sunday afternoon.
That's a neat little coffee joint.
Yeah, Lawrence is just a neat little town.
Yeah, it's nice.
I love Lawrence. It's really good. But yeah, I like when places let you change your name. But I got Dan Reichert on pretty much everything now, except for PSN.
You know, I changed my actual name when I married
That's
you.
True. That yeah. is true. That is actually a harder thing to do than most platforms, because you got to get, like, judges involved or mailing out passports or something.
Yeah,
or...
like certified copy of your marriage license. Like, yeah. It should just be like, oh, you want to change your name? All right, here's sign this thing and send it to the Social Security office.
But... I guess when it's like your government name and all your stuff and your taxes and everything are tied to it, and
it's
your
a
Social
whole
Security,
to do.
It is a whole to do.
But at least it's possible, whereas with some of these platforms, it's just impossible.
It's true. It's true. The government allows you to do that, but PlayStation, until recently, did not. The government won PlayStation 0.
That's right.
Yes, they didn't make a PlayStation 0. They started with 1, but they didn't call it 1 back then.
At least it's not a super unfortunate name. Like, some people, you know, made these really stupid usernames back in the day.
Oh,
forever bound to them.
Yeah, it's Bong Ripper Goku 69 or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Although, there is a certain style of old gamer tag type stuff that I almost have, like, a wistful nostalgia for. Like, if I see someone with that, with, like, the bunch of X's and stuff.
A lowercase X, an uppercase X, like, eights instead of A's and threes instead of E's and upper and lower and upper and a camel case. Yeah, but I'm glad I didn't stick with my, like, screen names from AOL days, because my one would have been so bad nowadays, but it was Right Wing Mormon, which I had, ironically.
It was tongue-in-cheek, right?
Yeah, I was 12, I was like, this will be funny.
That's a weird thing for a 12-year-old to do.
I know, but when you're listening to Thought Industry, it suddenly makes perfect sense. All Guns Blazing, which is actually, I think, would have been cool nowadays, but...
You didn't have to put any numbers or anything on that? Or any, like, weird, the L is a capital I or anything?
Maybe it was the L's were ones or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but yeah.
Yeah. Mine was always just some variation on some, like, Homer Simpson thing or something. Mm. It was not clever by any means.
My brother Dan had the best screen name ever. It was Megadeth Drum Fire.
It's pretty good. Did he hang on to that? Or is it an old AOL one?
It's an old AOL one, yeah.
Doesn't your mom still use AOL?
Yep.
I forget that AOL still exists, and then every once in a while, like, I'll see your mom's email, and I'll be like, oh, AOL.
It's like, I don't know if I could send you attachments. Like,
If I saw, like, if I drove past a Blockbuster or something, and just be like, whoa, they still make those, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure every time she calls customer service and gives her email address, it's an audible eye roll on the other end.
As someone who worked tech support in 2009, AOL had a certain stigma to it. So, yes. That takes us right to Apocalypse Now.
That's right. That's right. Perfect jumping off point.
You know
Nothing
what? We're
says
pros.
Plunging into the heart of darkness like talking about old screen
AOL,
names.
Yes. AOL was the heart of darkness for a while. Yes. God, where do we start? Here's the thing. I feel like there's so much to talk about here. We'll talk about specific scenes and stuff like that, but we definitely don't need to go beat by beat. We watched this movie the other night. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about it since.
Yeah, so have I. It's kind of been just like hanging over me. Like, a cloud implies something bad, but yeah. It's like kind of got its hold on my brain.
Yeah, this movie will do that. It is deeply about. It's not about the brain. It's about like the soul and morality and the evil that lives within man's soul and stuff. You know.
Yeah. It is just about darkness and walking over that line into complete nihilism and just how horrible mankind is capable of being.
Now tell me this, because so for some context, you had not seen this movie.
No.
When I was a like 17-year-old idiot and I was like, I need to watch all the classics. I'm going to be a film guy. I rented it, but I think I expected just like, oh, this is going to be like a Vietnam War movie. I probably rented it the same way I would rent like Rambo or something, mm-hmm. which actually maybe a bad example because the first Rambo actually does kind of deal with this stuff. But you know what I mean? The same way I didn't appreciate RoboCop when I rented it because I was expecting it to be something else. I don't know what I was expecting from this, but I don't remember paying a lot of attention to it, or it really, I don't remember a lot of it from back then. So for all intents and purposes, I feel like this was my first time really watching it. You had not seen it at all. So when we brought this up as something we were going to do for our ongoing Coppapalooza, mm-hmm. it's hard to say, series of Francis Ford Coppola movies, what did
Coppapalooba-ba-da-bam-boom.
Let's go with that. You're going to have to spell that out on the Patreon post. What did you expect? What did you think this was going to be like after seeing The Godfather? You know?
Yeah. So after seeing The Godfather, you know, obviously I had high expectations going into Apocalypse Now. But at the same time, I was kind of coming at it from a similar place that you were just describing. Like, I knew it was a war movie. I feel like war movies are obviously, you know, it deals with some very heavy subject matter.
Of course.
But once you're in the war movie and watching the war movie, you know kind of what to expect. There's going to be a lot of people, a lot of death, a lot of, you know, loud scenes and gunfire and everything like that. That's kind of what I expected. I expected it to be a movie about war.
A war movie, like the same way like Private Ryan would be like, well, you said you have not seen Private Ryan, is that right?
I did when I was a kid.
Oh, you're really young. That's right. Yeah, I think that's more of a traditional war movie in that it's like, okay, here's the D-Day scene. Here's the scene where mm-hmm. they go into this country and this battle happens or whatever. And it's amazing. And a traditional war movie can be incredible, like Saving Private Ryan. But did you anticipate any kind of the like psychological aspect of this?
No, it was so unbelievably dark. And when I learned that it was based on a novel that had nothing to do with a war, let alone the Vietnam War,
yeah.
it made it that much more impactful for me because it was like, okay, this is kind of an allegory for this Heart of Darkness thing, like going deeper into the depths of darkness and mankind's soul.
Yeah.
And it's taking place in Vietnam War, which by all accounts was like the manifestation of exactly that. This is the perfect setting. And it wasn't, you know, just the nature of the Vietnam War made it so it wasn't this like nonstop shooting fest. It was kind of like these long, slow moving, eerie moments that were more or less just like these guys kind of being bored and just passing time.
And there's time where they're just like drinking beer or like jet skiing or water skiing on the back of the boat.
And then all of a sudden you're getting shot at and you don't know what's going on. It's like the enemy was omnipresent, but you didn't know exactly where and exactly when they were going to strike at you. It was an enemy you couldn't see. So the entire movie had this like constant tension. And as they go further up the river, it just gets... they become more unhinged, the surroundings just become darker, and the people they encounter become more desperate. It just gets it's just such a perfect metaphor for just like going deeper into hell.
Yeah, and that whole the Heart of Darkness is such a great title for the book and the concept of venturing further into the Heart of Darkness. But I will say, as good of a title a Heart of Darkness is, Apocalypse Now is a fucking good title for a movie.
Yeah, and you know, I had heard the name Apocalypse Now before, and I never knew that, okay, this was the war movie. I didn't know what this movie was about. And then I learned, like, oh, okay, it's Apocalypse Now. So that made me a little more intrigued once I put together that, like, okay, Apocalypse Now is a war movie. I wonder why it's called that and not just, like, oh, going up the river on a mission or something.
Yeah, wartime buddies.
A terrible movie title. But.
Yes. No, but, I mean, it's not hyperbolic or anything. Mm-hmm. And, like, actually, we did watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness as well, which is about the making of this, which was a tremendously troubled production. But Coppola talks in the documentary about how, like, there's such a line between, like, what's worse than being pretentious. And I feel like if he had not made this movie so massive, masterfully, mm-hmm. it could feel pretentious of just like, oh, we're going to do a war movie, but it's about the soul and morality and stuff. Like, if he didn't do this right, he could have blown it and it could be pretentious, but it's not pretentious at all.
Yeah, well, especially it's a fine line to walk, especially in the final act, which, you know, I won't get into right now. But like up until then, you're more or less just presenting the horrors of this war, which just, I mean, holy shit, it is just. But okay, let's set it up first, because that the initial scene with Martin Sheen, aka Willard, Captain Willard, just kind of being alone in a bedroom
in Saigon,
in Saigon, alone with his thoughts, and that alone just kind of is a perfect showcase of, like, you know, this war and war in general is just unspeakably terrible, because look at this person who's in a safe environment, in a mm-hmm. bedroom with a comfy bed, you know, how he can't even just sit still and just think of anything other than just the itch to get back, even though he's like simultaneously hates it. It's like what he needs. Like, how do you return to civilization after experiencing something like that? And I think that opening scene of Willard kind of just like, I mean, you just see him kind of losing his mind a little bit. It's a perfect encapsulation of like, okay, we are going to see, we are in for some stuff in this movie.
Yeah. And the narration makes it clear that, you know, when he was in the shit, all he wanted was to get out of it. And when he went home, all he could think about was going mm-hmm. back there. And it's really interesting, because obviously PTSD and mental health and things like that have become much more a part of the national conversation, specifically around like war and veterans and things like that. But I have to imagine it was barely talked about back then, right. You know? And even when I was a kid, I remember, you know, you would hear about nom vets who were probably in their like 40s or whatever when I was a kid. It was like, oh, yeah, you know, they got shell shocked or whatever. Nom, they saw some shit and they came back and, oh, crazy nom vets or whatever. But then this movie was like actually doing a nuanced look at like PTSD and stuff before people were even saying PTSD, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, they Coppola mentioned that in the Hearts of Darkness documentary, how like there was this version of the war that was being put forth by the media in the United States, but the realities were so, so much worse. And it was, you know, like anyone who's been in a U.S. history class, it was a war that was, you know, a lot of people did not want this war to happen yeah. in the United States. And it was like heavily protests. And it was so bad to the point that the soldiers returning home would not be greeted with open arms. No, like, yellow ribbons around the mailboxes or whatever. Like, they were openly, like, tortured.
Yeah, and that's what the first Rambo was
about. Verbally tortured. Yeah, yeah. It was really, really terrible. I can't even imagine. But just in terms of this being a movie about entertainment, first and foremost, the scene where he gets his mission is, oh my God.
It is
so
some
good.
Metal Gear-ass mission briefing stuff. And, like, first of all, from the very beginning, it starts with the end by the Doors playing. Mm-hmm. And I don't like the Doors. I think they're pretty obnoxious and Jim Morrison drives me nuts. But it fits perfectly for
totally
the era,
agree.
For the movie yeah. and everything. So right away, I'm like, okay, this might be pretty good. The tone is immediately set at the beginning of the hotel scene and the end. But then they go into the mission briefing and I'm just like, oh, fuck, I'm going to love this, aren't I?
Yeah.
Because when they describe what this movie is about at the outset, it is full-on beginning of a Metal Gear movie where it's like, there is a rogue colonel. This guy was like an absolute top of his class, you know, like third-generation soldier, Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando. We just see him in pictures for most of the movie here at the beginning. That is, he's gone rogue. He's out in Cambodia, last I know of him. he's got like his own weird army that he's commanding around.
Almost, they make it seem like it's like a cult.
Yeah, exactly. But they're saying he's like fighting his own war. And like he's doing things like he's assassinating like political leaders and stuff like that. So he's like kind of fighting the Vietnam War on his own terms, right, which is such a crazy concept. And they only see him through like blurry photographs and like these cryptic audio recordings and stuff. And I love the phrase like, you know, terminate Kurtz's command with extreme prejudice. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so cool. And Harrison Ford's there. And like just the tone of all the commanders when they're talking about it, they were just like, hey, this is going to be fucked. And we're going to send you on this is a bad mission.
Yeah, it's super secret because people can't know that they're killing one of their own.
Yeah.
And even the people that are helping Willard along the way don't know the nature of the mission. He can't talk about it. But yeah, he obviously, as we saw in the moments before, in the scene before this, where he's kind of writhing around in his bedroom, he desperately needs a mission and he absolutely is on board for this.
Yeah.
Even though he kind of like, that's one of the things that I love about Martin Sheen is like, kind of throughout the movie, he's so indifferent. He just seems so singularly focused on the mission. And I'm sure that's kind of in a way, not that I would feign to know anything about what it's like to be in a war, but I imagine you kind of have to approach the situations with that kind of indifference, like to
detach
just,
from
exactly, yeah, just focus solely on what the mission is, and because if you're reactive to things, I imagine that would not be in your best interest.
Well, and the way it's presented though, like every time he's getting these dossiers and reading updates about Colonel Kurtz,
oh my
and his
God,
location
so
and
well
stuff,
done.
It's super well done. You hear the narration, and like it's never Martin Sheen at no point is like, I'm gonna get this motherfucker.
Right.
It's not like that. He's more just kind of like reading all this stuff and being like, what happened to this guy?
Yeah.
He's more like fascinated by
it. He's fascinated. You could tell in a way he kind of admires him. And he seems more like curious than like just dead set on killing this guy. And that's the thing, too. We learn a little bit about Kurtz as they take their voyage up the river. And it kind of like being able to hear so much about him, what this guy's accomplished, what he's doing, without actually seeing him.
Mm-hmm.
The movie kind of builds him up to be this godlike figure. And
yeah,
at the end, when we finally do encounter him, it's like very much that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's how he's treated in the movie.
Oh, and the audio recordings and stuff, they're just so cryptic and
yeah,
weird. We're talking about having a dream about a snail going along the edge of a razor blade and stuff. Mm. And it's just like, man, there's just a weird vibe to this movie that sets itself apart right away. And like the music, the soundtrack is so like
so well done.
It's like this, it's just almost like this hallucination throughout.
Yeah.
But then there's also like, you know, the Nam songs and the bands and stuff, you know, you're hearing stuff like the Doors and Suzy Q and mm-hmm, stuff playing. And it really just puts you into this, again, not that we would ever know what it's like or what Nam was like or anything like that, but like it sets you in this time and place and also this mood.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. The atmosphere, it's just so, so eerie. It's so well done. And it like the movie is clearly marked by like some key parts that I feel like you can, if you were to trace, you would see the clear descent into madness kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first kind of big set piece moments is when they meet Kilgore, who they're going to meet up with this guy, and then Willard is taking a few of his men, and then they're going to continue up the river. But Kilgore is played by Robert Duvall, and he's fucking brilliant in it.
He's incredible. He's so good.
He's good.
Nominated for an Oscar for this.
Yeah, he's like, he is completely unfazed by, I guess, the mortars going off around him.
Everything.
Whole,
like, there's an active, like, war zone around him.
Yeah, he's totally unfazed by it. He learns that one of these kids is this guy, Lance, who's a professional surfer, and Kilgore just loves surfing, and he just becomes obsessed with surfing, and like all the explosions will make a nice current in the water, so he insists like you could either surf or you have to fight.
Yeah, in the middle of the battle he's like, Lance, take a look at this, the waves are breaking this way and that way, there are people shooting and everything, like in the midst of like this crazy helicopter scene where there's the part where that woman comes up and throws the grenade
mm-hmm,
in the helicopter, like that's fucked up. And then when you hear about the making of it, that they were actually like renting or utilizing those helicopters from like where was it? The Philippines?
Yeah.
The army. And like they would have to leave that scene to go like fight rebels in real life and then come back and keep filming.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is this sense of like authenticity around the whole
totally,
movie. And also in Hearts of Darkness, we learned that so many of the people involved were at kind of fucked up points in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Sheen was kind of fucked up at this point. Coppola was convinced this movie was going to be an absolute failure and he was like bankrolling it himself. And
right. Yeah, well, like their characters in the movie, and their personal lives, they're really in this environment while they're filming, and it's the production was, you know, if you watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness, you'd see like the production was just a shit show. So they themselves are being affected by the environment in the same way that their characters are, kind of.
Yeah. I also heard that on the set, Dennis Hopper got Lawrence Fishburne, like, I don't know if it was full on hooked on or like introduced to like hard drugs. And Lawrence Fishburne was like between 14 and 17 when they were filming this.
Wow.
And like, that's the thing, the authenticity, like Dennis Hopper, we'll get to like his role, but like he is playing this real spaced out kind of hippie type guy. And like, he feels authentic mm-hmm. in this movie because Dennis Hopper is kind of a known madman yeah. or was. Yeah, it just feels extremely authentic. And yeah, you were talking about Duvall and the Kilgore scene, the very famous Ride of the Valkyries playing mm-hmm. while all the helicopters are coming in. Just incredible, incredible
so
scene.
Good.
And then the like the campfire at night when yep. they're all like, they just went through all this hell and they're just, you know, at a campfire giving each other shit and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I
and then
it.
When after like the I love the smell of napalm in the morning, he goes like, oh, this war will end someday, and it's just like reminds you that like, oh yeah, like that's the one thing this movie never addresses is like what the ultimate goal of the Vietnam War was. Like when the end was, there really wasn't ever an end in sight. The goalpost was just like constantly shifting until they were just like, oh fuck it, let's just throw in the towel. Like,
yeah, I, you know, I am certainly no expert in the Vietnam War or any part of it really. But after watching like this movie and learning a little bit more in recent months about Vietnam, I can't imagine what it was like being on the ground there as an American soldier. Because it's like, wait, what is this? Isn't World War II? You're not out there, you know, fighting the Nazis. It's like, wait, why are we here? What's the point? Why are we all dying in this horrible fashion? Like, you know, like, wouldn't you constantly be asking, like, what the fuck are we here for?
Well, I'm sure if you were there, you wouldn't be, you'd probably just be focused on what you had to do.
I guess, but oh my God, like, I could completely understand how that whole generation that got drafted and everything would be incredibly bitter and struggling with a lot of things from that war.
Yeah. Yeah, looking at the movie in retrospect, it's like Kilgore is kind of the exact opposite of Kurtz in that he's just completely sold himself on like the U.S. team just being better, like morally, like they, like Vietnam, the Vietnamese soldiers were just savages in according to like Kilgore's perspective.
Yeah.
That just had to be decimated where, you know, Kurtz, that's the thing about Kurtz that I love about Kurtz is he obviously total nihilist, but he had some good points. Like the whole like idea of morality just seems so arbitrary. And at the end of the day, it's you're just killing people for what? You know what I mean? Well, it's all so futile. Like everything is so meaningless.
Yeah. And I want to when we talk about the ending, I want to talk about some of the things he said about like things he witnessed and that kind of changed his way of thinking and stuff, which is incredibly fucked up stuff he's saying. But it's just like you're trying to see his weird, twisted logic and how he got mm-hmm. to this point after being this like straight laced soldier and what the things he saw in Nam did to him. But yeah, on the way there, it's like it's interesting because I was kind of thinking of the Odyssey while I was watching it, where it's like this journey and there's all these like little stops along the way and these characters that come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Coppola that brought it up in the Coppola or the screenwriter compared it to the Odyssey. And it's like, oh yeah, so like Duvall and Kilgore are like the Cyclops. And it's like, okay, we pass them. And then like the Playboy bunnies at the USO show are like the sirens, you know. Mm. And that's such a jarring thing too. And like imagine being shot at all day and going through hell. And then it's like there's this USO show where it's just like, hey, we're playing music. And,
yeah.
you know, it's a show, everyone. Here's
yeah,
some boobs. Get horny,
time.
Everyone.
Yeah.
yeah, it's like, just imagine the whiplash
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
That seems crazy too. It's like the way they come upon it too, where they're just like, they go from like, hey, we're just on the river on our mission, and they see lights and everything and activity, and they're like, whoa, what's this? And it's like, oh, I guess we're looking at boobs now. Like,
yeah.
It's, oh, man.
And then they all obviously get a little too excited and chase the playmates onto the helicopter.
Hanging on to the yeah. the runners of the helicopter, yeah.
Yeah, but that's another thing. I mean, you talk about influences. This movie is so parallels the Aguirre Wrath of God in the most obvious way being that it's a voyage on a river where things just get progressively worse and worse.
And people lose their minds.
People lose their minds, yeah. It's an interesting parallel to that. But, yeah. Yeah, that scene was bonkers.
yeah, and it was around here, I think, that the fishing boat massacre happens, right?
Yeah.
Generally around, like, this midpoint
uh-huh.
where, yeah, I think in the documentary they said they wanted it to be, like, the My Lai massacre, where, again, I don't know the specifics, but I know a lot of innocent people got slaughtered, and that's what happens in this fishing boat thing. And you were very worried about the puppy.
Right. As soon as I saw a puppy, I got worried that I would have to see this puppy die. It was an unbelievably cute little puppy. Didn't know what was going on. Just wanted to be a puppy and be comfy and maybe...
Sit in a basket.
Sit in a basket and be loved. I was really worried that we would see the dog die.
We do not.
Thankfully, we do. I don't know what happens to the puppy. No one does. But it probably didn't turn out well for the little guy.
We do not see. We can't know for sure.
We can't know for sure.
But it did not go well for the other people on the boat because it was the woman scrambling for the puppy is what is it? It's clean, right? Lawrence Fishburne like has the turret and he just starts just smoking them all.
Yeah.
And it's just this huge massacre. And it's like these things happen. And just the way everyone on the boat reacts, it's just like, fuck. Like, you know, like they're already so deep in the shit and everything. And like now this and it's like, oh, we just killed a bunch of innocent people. And
yeah, but it doesn't really seem like they're reacting like, oh, we just killed a bunch of innocent people. No, it's like they're totally like, ah, damn. Oh, well, you know what I mean? Like they are so desensitized to taking lives. And I'm sure in the process of, you know, these attacks on villages, a ton of innocent people have died and they've seen a ton of innocent people die. And, you know, this, I'm sure in their mind, like, the lady just shouldn't have moved.
Well,
And it just goes to show their mental state, too, that, like, Lawrence Fishburne is just so on edge that this woman moving slightly towards the puppy is what just killed all of them.
Well, yeah, and then, like, some characters do get to a breaking point at some, and sometimes it's more dramatic than others, but, like, there's the part with the tiger where they're going out in the forest. It's Chef is one of the guys on the boat, and Willard are going out looking for something.
Mangoes,
that's right. And a tiger just kind of pounces out of nowhere, and Chef just gets it back on the boat, and oh my god, his acting was amazing here, where he's just losing his fucking mind. Like, it was like that breaking point of, like, all these accumulated horrors and everything, and then he just snapped. You know, like the adrenaline or something, just something snapped in him.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, on top of everything else, that nature is working against you as well.
Yeah. Yeah, they talk about how humid it is, and they're all just constantly sweating the entire time, because they're actually on a river. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually super humid. And then Lance, oh my god, this seems like a nightmare to me. Lance starts doing LSD. At first, he's just smoking a lot of, like, pot and stuff. And then he starts, like, dropping LSD. And I've never done LSD, but I cannot imagine being on weed in that situation. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine being in that situation. If you look at any kind of drug or anything, I am going to not have a good time.
Yeah, I would imagine that being on LSD in the midst of that could either go really well or really poorly.
I guess if you were out of it enough and you just didn't even really associate it with real danger or what was happening, which that's kind of what it seems like Lance is doing. Like, he's going through, like, these battles and stuff, just kind of, like, looking at it like, whoa, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you get to a point where, you know, you don't even really care about self-preservation. Like, you get so used to just, like, death being all around you that the idea of you dying is just isn't, like, a thing that induces fear anymore once you get to that point, you know? And, yeah, he just gets so as the voyage goes on, he just gets more and more, it seems like, dependent on drugs. Like, he's just constantly high. He always seems high. And I'm glad that they included that, because that's one of the things that you hear a lot about what happened to soldiers at Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They come back with these horrible addictions. So on top of everything else.
Well, and on top of that, we talk about authenticity. The actor said he dropped acid and was on speed and stuff. And like that was all authentic, too. Like that's insane.
Yeah. Well, Coppola seemed to like encourage them to like not necessarily try to inhibit any characters other than like what they themselves would be like in these situations.
Martin Sheen actually drinking in the hotel and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually like that blood was really like he really punched the mirror and geez, this is a fucked up movie.
Yeah. And totally like we learned that a lot of like Brando's stuff was improvised and whatnot. So yeah, there's a lot of that. Very like that's probably what contributed to it feeling so real is that they're really feeling the things that they're feeling and stuff. I mean, to an extent, obviously their lives weren't in that much danger, but while they were filming, but so this goes to like one of my favorite parts in the movie is when they get to the final outpost, the final American outpost,
the last one in Vietnam before they cross over into Cambodia. The bridge.
And as soon as they're on their boat and as soon as they start sailing past it to find a place to dock up. I don't know. What do you call it? Break? What is it? Park their boat? What is it called when you stop a boat?
Dock?
Anchor?
An anchor stops a boat.
They're looking for a place to anchor their boat.
Dock their port.
And all of these soldiers just come out into the water, like, trying to get onto the boat and be like, please take me with you. You know that something fucked up is happening.
Yeah, it's like, this is not how soldiers typically act.
Yeah, they just desperately want to get out of there. And it becomes clear that there's no CO, there's no commanding officer, and that everyone's just kind of on their own here, just trying to survive. And there's this really awesome sequence with this, like, guitar playing, and, like, there's, you know, Charlie's all around him. And at one point, they wake up this guy who's just, I couldn't tell if he was just, like, stoned out of his mind or if he was sleeping or what.
Shell-shocked or...
I mean, he was obviously completely shell-shocked, but he's just, like, he takes his, like, grenade launcher and everything's completely quiet. And he's just, I guess he's just become so second-natured and just, like, so singularly focused on his job, which is to kill VCs, that he's able to, like, just by sound detect where they are, like a radar.
Emotionless.
And just totally, like, oh, emotionless. Eyes completely wide. Yeah. Just unable to do anything other than that. Like Willard asks him, like, who's the CO? Or do you know who the CO is? And the guy's like, yeah, I do. And just like...
yeah, just like the most basic questions or whatever. And he's just like, oh, no, I'm just... They're on autopilot in, like, the most hellish situation. And so it's like, how long has it been like this? How long have they been, like, at this bridge outpost just fighting... The jungle and the forest, or, you know, the people out there in the trees. It's just like, that is, we talked earlier about the unseen enemy part of it. And there is something so terrifying about that. And the movie, it's got to be intentional. You never really, this isn't a movie about the Viet Cong at all. You don't really see them for the most part. It's just like, there are scenes where the boat will just be, they'll be chatting and having beers and stuff. And then a million, like, spears and stuff will just out of nowhere start coming from the jungle. And it kills the pilot of the boat or the captain of the boat. And just imagine living like that. Like, every day, how would you ever sleep a second?
Yeah.
You know, and the movie is, yeah, it is a Vietnam War movie, but it is not a, like, here's the battle of this. It is just, like, emulating the horror.
Yeah.
Is definitely a theme of this movie.
For sure. And, I mean, that last outpost comes, like, way into their journey. Like, it's not something that's easily accessible. So those guys are so far out. They're so removed from any kind of help or, you know, support or any kind of, like, you know, what is it? Like a
backup.
Or... Yeah. They're just kind of resigned to their fate almost, that all they're doing is killing and there's no hope for escape. That scene was just bonkers. And that was like, that scene was like truly a horror movie kind of.
Mm-hmm. And the other guys who are still alive, they don't even know why they're there. They don't even know what Willard's mission is. They're just like, I don't know. We're supposed to be on this boat and he's got to get up there and then we'll drop him off or something.
Yeah. And that's like when we start to see kind of Willard conflicting with Chief, who's the sailor of the boat. The boat's
captain.
Yeah, because it's really interesting. Like, the chief has been kind of complacent and like, all right, well, he has to be up here for some mission. I don't know what it is, but we got to get him up there. And then it gets to a certain point that even he's like, we can't go beyond this. This is crazy. We just can't. And then he ends up getting a spear through him, and the remaining guys continue forth into essentially the gates of hell.
yeah. As they, I mean, the next stop is, once they get past that, is the compound is all that's up there. And what a striking moment when they first approach it. Like, the way it's shot, it's just like, it's not like this, you know, horror music or anything like
it's
that.
Shot so plainly.
Yeah. It's just like, you see it the way that Willard would see it, where it's like, what's this? You know, like, no music. If I remember right, there's no...
I think there was like
really subtle?
Really subtle, like minimalist music. But
yeah. And it's just like, all of these like villagers covered in this white chalky.
They look like ghosts.
Yeah. And they're just standing on these things in the river, like these little canoes and stuff, and all around the banks and everything, just staring. Just, you know, they don't seem hostile, but there's something off about this whole situation. And then you start looking like, as they start getting closer and closer to the compound, there's just like bodies everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's just like hanging in trees, like on the banks, like decapitated limbs, things hanging. It's just like, absolute hell.
Piles of skeletons and stuff. Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
But it's clear though that if Kurtz wanted them dead, he would have just immediately killed them. But instead, they're able to go in and.
Dennis Hopper kind of greets them and says, "Hey, do the siren. That'll get them to scatter." Yeah.
Yeah, Dennis Hopper's character is interesting.
Yeah, I forgot he was in this, and so as soon as he starts, I was like, "Hey guys, come on!" I was like, "Oh fuck, I forgot about him."
It's abundantly unclear how he got there, because he doesn't seem particularly capable in battle.
Oh no, he has 14 cameras though.
Yeah, maybe he went a different route. But
he's a photojournalist, American photojournalist.
Well, I'm saying, like, how do you even get there in the first place?
Oh yeah. God. Yeah, and so this is the last act of the movie is all in the compound, and pretty quickly you meet Kurtz. He's in this temple type situation, and Brando, there is a real, I haven't seen a lot of Brando, but there is a presence about him every second he's on screen there. There's this like intensity and this weirdness, and it's even watching the documentary, he showed up out of shape, even though he promised to be in shape. He had all these demands and everything. He hadn't read Heart of Darkness like he was supposed to. So you would think that he doesn't give a shit. But then it's like you see the performance, and it's like, oh my God, is he just that good that he can just pull this out of his ass? Mm-hmm. But then in the documentary, too, you saw that he was spending entire days sitting with Coppola and talking about his character and stuff. So he just must have a certain way that he finds these performances or whatever, because it works.
Yeah, it's interesting with Brando. Like, I saw Last Tango in Paris, which I watched that one by myself. But in Godfather, he's definitely, I don't want to say a caricature, but that's more of this kind of, like, mythologized, like, the Don, you know what I mean? Like, you don't really see a lot of him being a normal person. He's always being the Don in that movie.
Sure.
But in Last Tango in Paris, he's just kind of being his unfiltered self. And seeing that and then seeing this and seeing his behavior on set, I think that a lot of times he's just kind of playing himself a lot.
And he's nuts, right?
Completely insane. Completely insane. And that, you know, seeing Last Tango in Paris, I didn't necessarily know that. I thought it was just the character. But now seeing this, I'm kind of like, all right, there is something really strange about this guy. But it was perfect for this role, of course.
That's the thing is, like, when I was growing up and when I was a kid in the 90s, he was still a big name and stuff like that. You know, actually, we're about to watch Island of Dr. Moreau, the really bad 96 one. And, like, the thing that people always said before they even said, like, oh, one of the great actors is, like, Marlon Brando is just a weirdo. That's his whole thing, is that he's just an absolute maniac. Yeah, so it's interesting to, like, actually see some of his work and everything. And, like, I'm always fascinated by actors or entertainers in general that are like that, where it's like, you're so undeniably, like, one of the best ever at this, but what is going on with you? What's your deal, you know?
Right, right, yeah. I mean, he was just completely, like, completely about acting, and it just didn't seem like there was much else there.
Quick aside, did you know that there was a movie, in reading about Brando, there's a movie that came out in like 91 or the early 90s. I think it's called The Freshman. It's with Matthew Broderick, and he's basically playing Vito Corleone.
Oh, no, I didn't know
that. It's a comedy where it's like Matthew Broderick is like a kid who gets like pulled into the mob or whatever, and he has to work with this mafia godfather, and it's just straight up Brando doing that character again. Like, it's not the same name, but it's so clearly like, oh, it's just Brando doing the godfather again. Wow. It's like, that seems like a weird novelty.
It is weird. I definitely want to go back and watch some of like his you know, best peak Brando, like Streetcar Named Desire.
Sure.
I definitely want to watch that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, he's incredible in this role. Kurtz as a character is just, after him being built up for so long, it just totally pays off, because he is this just kind of like this idol to just strength above all else, and just not, and this idea of humanity, just, you know, just calling that for like the hollow idea that it is.
It's like Dennis Hopper says, like, oh, he's like a poet warrior in the classic sense of the word. And like, and he does kind of, he just sits around and reads poetry and says this stuff about like, he saw, like when he was in the army proper and everything, they went and tried to inoculate a bunch of villagers and gave him shots. Like, I don't know if it was polio. Yeah. And then I guess the insinuation was that, like, so the leaders of the village came out and chopped off all the kids' arms, I guess out of distrust of what the American soldiers were injecting them with?
I interpreted it as less distrust and more just, like, a statement. Like,
you can't come here and do this?
Yeah.
And just, like, Kurtz almost admired, even though it was, like, he refers to it as the horror. You know, he talks about the horrors he's seen. But he almost admires just just the extreme nature of just like how like the fact that they were able to do that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he calls it specifically, uses the word like the purity of it, and just how like, you know, there's no false conceptions of morality or anything. It's just pure, just one v one, like strength above all else. And I think it's that strength, you know, that is ultimately what attracted this giant cult of villagers and soldiers around him. I mean, one of the little anecdotes we learned while they're en route to the compound is that there was someone else that had Willard's mission before him.
Exact same mission, yeah.
Someone that we can assume was a highly capable soldier. I mean, they're obviously only sending really capable people out to try to, you know, sneak into the cult and kill Kurtz, but this guy decided not to come back and that he's just going to follow Kurtz now. So that says a lot too, how undeniable this guy's strength is.
In the part where they get to the compound and Willard sees the guy and they just kind of look, you know, eye to eye, you know, straight mm-hmm. into each other's faces, and like nothing is even said. Mm-hmm. I love that because like the movie is subtle when it needs to be, and it's just like there's not this whole thing like, who are you? How did this happen? You know, it's not that.
Totally.
It's just looking into his eyes and you can tell, you know, there's no narration, but you can just tell Willard's thinking like, what happened? What did he do?
I don't think he's thinking what happened. I think that he sees that guy and because I think Willard, I get the sense that he was really conflicted too, because I think in a way he admired Kurtz and he can completely empathize with what he's saying, and whether or not he wants to like actually admit it, that you know admitting it, I feel like if you even acknowledge that something like that is true, you'd cross a line that you could never return back to. But you know, that's why I was not sure when Willard got to the compound that he was actually going to follow through in his mission.
Sure.
You know, I would have totally bought if he, you know, would have become a follower or anything like that. And I think that's kind of that conflict is one of the things that the movie presents to us, because we're not really sure exactly what will happen. And that's what makes it so interesting and intriguing. Because even though Willard is tortured and put in this bamboo cage and everything, and, you know, his chef's head is beheaded, decapitated,
oh my God,
head is thrown on his lap.
Yeah, while he's, like, tied up to this thing. It's like, oh, fuck, Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And that's, like, the movie is a few hours long, but, you know, it takes place over the course of many months, if not a year, right? I mean, many,
sure.
many months. So, and you're with these guys for the whole time. I can't imagine the bond that you have with these people after not only being around them for so long, but surviving these life and death situations and seeing things that no one else would be able to relate to. And then to have that guy's head just thrown in your lap.
Well, and also the way it happened, he kind of wakes up and looks up and Colonel Kurtz is there and he's mm-hmm. got like the U.S. Army style like camo on his face and he's just like staring at him. And then he just like, you know, unceremoniously tosses the head in his lap.
He walks
like,
away.
Oh my God, did Kurtz like put on makeup to go out to the boat and behead his friend? Mm-hmm. And holy shit, you know? And it makes you think, too, that, like, how did he get this influence over these villagers who don't speak English and stuff? And it's like, he's clearly big on, like, these things that you don't need words to
yeah,
get across what
absolutely.
He's doing here.
Absolutely, yeah. And, yeah, so the chef was told that if Willard isn't back within a certain amount of hours to call in an airstrike, but Kurtz decapitates him before he can do that.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
I think it's so rare that a character in a movie is built up to be such a big thing, you know, that you put so much stock behind it and so much of the plot and gravitas behind it, and then it pays off.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it surpassed. Like, I mean, this whole movie is about hunting this guy,
yeah.
and you don't see him for like 2 hours almost,
yeah.
you know?
And even when you finally see him, you don't really see him because he's like cloaked in the shadows most of the time. And I'm wondering if part of that was done because Brando was so overweight that they wanted to conceal that. But I think it really worked for the benefit of the movie because it still kind of enshrouded him. I feel like seeing him plainly, you would have just seen a person. But barely seeing him, getting hints of him, and you more feel him than see him. You know what I
mean?
Yeah,
he's a presence. Like the whole compound, you know,
you
can tell he presides over this thing. And also they say that like he's dying of malaria, basically. So the jungle is actually killing him. And he wants to go out on his feet like a soldier. So like he's not stopping Willard at all. Like
mm-hmm.
he knows why Willard's coming and doesn't stop it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think about this movie's influence a lot after I've seen it because I've seen a million references and things like that. And I tend to think about Metal Gear a lot. And Snake Eater, do you know the end of it? Where like, you know, Big Boss has to face the boss in the flower field.
Oh, right,
and it's like he actually, at this point, he doesn't know that she actually didn't betray the country. She was actually, you know, it's the duty over the morality and duty to the country. It's like, it's very much playing on those themes, not nearly as like subtly as Apocalypse Now, but like, I can think of all these different things where I'm like, oh, okay, that's clearly an Apocalypse Now thing. That scene in Hot Shots Part 2 makes sense now. Yes. But then the end, yeah, it's, I mean, he accomplishes his mission. He takes a machete to Kurtz and just packs him up.
Yeah.
And it's intercut with that, water buffalo.
Yeah. It's juxtaposed against that, this like ritual that the people in real life for shoot were actually performing this like human, this animal sacrifice.
Yeah.
So you get to see it on camera, which normally you don't see stuff like that in a movie because obviously animals are protected, but this was, this was a ritual. Yeah, it was really disturbing. I thought that was a perfect contrast to be interspliced with that. And it showed too, like, okay, I mean, to get more, more on the movie that on the level that this is an actual movie, it served as a way that the people would be distracted, from Willard sneaking in there and giving him the old machete.
Sure.
But not that he really resisted at all. He didn't resist, you know,
Even when he leaves, it's just like they're all like almost kneeling to him and parting while he grabs Lance, right? Lance is still alive and he's just kind of like, he's just out of his gourd,
right.
You know, and leaves with him. But yeah, there's never any threat to Willard. I mean, they're psychologically torturing him.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, the reason why the people followed Kurtz was his strength and the fact that Willard was able to kill him demonstrates Willard's strength. So I don't think they would have wanted to like get revenge, like, oh, you killed our leader. I think it was more admiration. Like they realized what happened and then they admired him.
Yeah. And again, if he was an enemy that Kurtz wanted dead, he would have been dead immediately.
Yeah.
Like the second he sailed up there.
And it just kind of ends like that. And I thought just the subtlety all the way through in that final act, there could have been so many opportunities for there to be a misstep where they were just too heavy handed and it just wouldn't have made sense in the context. But the whole thing was the psychological horror movie. And that whole last part is just pure psychological.
Well, that's the thing, is the original ending was going to be this kind of like action movie ending that the writer of the script was like, okay, so basically Willard joins Kurtz. And then when the airstrike comes, you know, Willard and Kurtz kind of fight it off and shoot down the helicopters and stuff. And that sounds awful. It sounds like Coppola always hated that idea. And it's just so interesting that Coppola was never confident about this movie, specifically the ending, because he only had Brando for like a few weeks. And otherwise, you know, he was already so deep in debt. And if they went one day over, it was just insane, Brando's terms. And so you see this footage of him and Brando on set, and he's just like, he doesn't know what he's going to do with the ending. Brando's wasting whole days and everything. And for it to all come together the way it did, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was just absolutely amazing. And when it ended and it was like, I realized like, oh, right, I'm living a life right now and my whole mind is no longer consumed by this movie. It just like we said earlier, it's just been lingering in there, just made its mark and just won't let go of my head. I just keep thinking about it. It was so incredible.
Well, I love how it ends too, with like when Kurtz dies, just the horror.
Yeah.
He just keeps repeating about the horrors he's seen. And it's just, I don't know, his delivery and everything. It's just incredible.
Oh man, it's one of the best movies I've ever seen. One of my favorite movies that I've ever seen in my whole life.
It's perfect. I'll call it a perfect movie. I mean, the effects, the music, you know, like it's a violent movie, but it's never like, it's never feels
gratuitous.
I mean, it's disgusting. I mean, the bodies and there's heads everywhere all over Kurtz's compound and then the animal slaughter, like, but it all just feels earned or it doesn't feel out of place.
It serves a purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, man, it's incredible. I heard that Godfather Part 2, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now are considered some of like the four greatest movies ever made by one director sequentially. So it makes me really excited about The Conversation.
Yes, we will check that out. But yeah, also before we ended on Apocalypse, we rented this on Amazon Prime. So if you want to see it, we watched the theatrical cut on Amazon Prime. But right afterwards, I bought the six disc like 4K thing with like all three versions of it and the documentary and all that. So there's the theatrical version, which is the one we saw, which I think it's paced perfectly. I am curious, just because I loved it so much, you know, before we watched it, I was like, oh, we could watch this final cut thing that came out, you know, a while ago, and you know, it's got 50 minutes of added footage and stuff. But I hadn't really seen it. But now I would actually watch that.
Yeah.
Even though, like, there was this French plantation scene that Coppola hated and he wasn't happy with the cast and stuff like that. And I heard it kind of screws up the pacing. But, like, just as someone who considers this one of the best movies he's ever seen now, I kind of do want to dive deeper. And I would totally watch that in the near future, yeah, even with you, now that we've got it.
Yeah. I can't imagine you. I hope the people listening to this have already seen it. But if you haven't seen it... and you don't mind that we just kind of spoiled a lot of it for you. If you're going to watch it, definitely save it for the nighttime. Make sure all the lights are off. Make sure it has your full attention.
If you got surround sound, crank that up.
Yeah, it's not something you want to watch on a Sunday afternoon.
No, and that's the thing, is that even though I had rented this and I've seen this movie before, I guarantee I was 17, sitting on the floor, watching it on a 19-inch shitty CRT, probably in the afternoon on a Saturday, and... That's just not, and also at 17 is probably not the time to.
You probably wouldn't have appreciated it.
No, this was the right time, and I actually really do just want to watch it again at some point.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. It was one of the darkest movies I've ever seen, for sure.
But again, earned. It doesn't feel like it's like, oh, edgelord, you know, we're trying absolutely to be fucked
not.
Up and dark.
No,
like, no, it's very earned.
Yeah, man, it was so good.
It's incredible. It's you know, when I always think about, like, my favorite movies of all time, you know, I think of the ones that are very much tailor-made to me and mm-hmm. my sensibilities of, you know, the Terminators and the Face-Offs and mm-hmm. The Rock and stuff like that. But, like, there's no fucking world where I can say that any of those are better movies than Apocalypse Now. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
in terms of,
different.
You know, favorite movie, sure, I'll say T2, The Rock, something like that. But in terms of, like, the best movie I've ever seen, I'm trying to think of one right now that I know that maybe there's some recency bias, but, like, there's nothing that immediately comes to mind as a better movie that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
This.
I mean, it's as far as like psychological horror. I mean, this is the most affecting one I've ever seen for sure.
Yeah.
It's definitely on my list of favorite movies of all time.
Yeah. So
rare thing indeed.
Yeah.
It was so good.
I loved seeing how much you were getting into it. Cause I remember at the beginning during the mission briefing, I was like looking over at you and stuff, and I could tell you were like, you know, you seemed into it. And I was like, oh, I forgot how like fucked up and psychological this movie is, and I was like, I think Bonk's gonna like this a lot. So yeah, check that movie out,
please.
Real good. It ended with Why Can't We Be Friends. I thought that was weird.
That was
a weird
strange
choice. Yeah, they fixed that,
but you know
what,
that contrast, it really highlights just how dark the movie was,
the duality of man and all that. Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. Coppola's a genius, so who are we to doubt him? That's gonna be it for
Oh wait, can I just say one thing too?
Yes,
before we completely get off it.
Yeah.
I love how there was no credits at the end. It just ended.
Mm-hmm.
There was no credits.
Yeah, yeah.
Just I thought that was a cool touch.
Copyright Zoetrope. Yeah. Oh man, it's so funny when like the nature of this podcast where we're just watching like random stuff that came up on Netflix or, you know, Search Party and the stuff that we really like and everything. But then when we do the Panty Awards at the end of the year, it's like, well, that Netflix movie we watched that came out this summer was pretty good, but also Apocalypse Now. it's like putting like Casablanca against Palm Springs. It's like, whoa, this is a weird award show.
Here. It is.
So you'll probably hear about this come late this year, but we will be thinking about Apocalypse Now for quite a long time.
That's right. It's quite the film. Thank you for watching it with me, Daniel.
Thank you for watching it with me, and thank you at home for listening to us talk about these movies. And thank
so
you.
Smooth.
That was pretty good, wasn't it? That was pretty good. And thank you all for supporting the Patreon. That is patreon.com/paintingthestream. Real easy, $5 a month. You get ad-free episodes.
Wow.
You get episodes a day early.
Wow.
You get access to the Discord.
Wow.
We got over 500 people in there now.
It's a lot
it
of
has
people.
Been excellent. It's a lot of people. And most importantly, you get For You, written for you by Bonk herself. A Bonk who? Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do, Daniel.
Who do we got?
This week, we are honoring our friend...
Honoring
our friend. This week, we are honoring our friend Jake.
Hey, Jake.
I know you're out there. I know you're a good person. Thank you for being a patron. I hope your day is filled with smiles.
Yes,
which
likewise.
Is a thing that I've been saying lately that I like to say.
That's a good thing to say.
And this Bonku is for you. The plan was ruined, and Jake knew all hope was lost. He sighed and let go.
Oh, geez. Jake on a Willard mission? Is he on his way to darkness?
Into the heart of darkness.
Oh, my goodness. All right, Jake. Well, hope things are good.
Enjoy your smiles.
Yeah, enjoy those smiles on your journey to the heart of darkness. Bonk, thanks for joining me each and every week
here. Thank you, sweetheart.
I already thanked you folks for listening, so thanks. And thanks, Tom Otto, for the theme song.
What about the Hugh game?
Oh, shit, I'm holding the card. I'm literally holding the card. I was going to say, my brain's a mental checklist. All right, we got a Hugh game card here. Who in your family has a personality that is the least like everyone else's?
My instinct is to say mine because I feel like very different from the rest of my family. But I would say, well, Grillman and Dan are very much alike. I feel like my brother Dan and Grillman are kind of the same sensibilities.
Sure.
My mom, Tommy is, Tommy is just, he's fantastic.
Are you just going to name everyone in your family?
I'm trying to think of me, I guess.
Yeah.
Stupid answer, but I know myself the most, and I always think, like, man, I'm so different from these people.
you are. There's definitely some similarities and sensibilities and stuff like that, but yeah, I could see that. I was not thinking about myself as a candidate for this question, so I was going to say my sister Kayla.
Well, Kayla is from outer space.
Yeah,
she's different from all of mankind.
She is. Like, I always, you know, was very close with her and got along with her really well because we both have a shared love of video games and stuff. But she's very just weird and in a good way, in a very, very likable, awesome way.
Yeah, she's just fantastic.
But I've never met anyone like Kayla.
Yeah. You know what? I'll amend my answer because I feel like an egomaniac saying myself. I'll say Aunt Donna. I've never met anyone as sweet as her.
She is incredibly sweet.
Like, just as sweet as the day is long. So yeah.
I would also throw my dad in as a possibility because he is just the weirdest fucking guy.
Oh, and he's so different from Mary and Diana.
Oh, my God.
What's so weird about your dad and his sisters is that they are all so different from each other.
The three of all of them are extremely... Mary is very kind of like hippie, Grateful Dead type, you know, still, you know, smoking all the time and stuff. And Diana's just very, very straight-laced, is probably, you know, like... I've never seen her drink alcohol or cuss or anything. She's just the most straight-laced, responsible person ever. And my dad's just a whole fucking thing. I would say me and my dad used to share more in common. That's not saying that we've gotten further apart or anything like that, but I feel like I have grown in a lot of ways. My dad is just... He is Paul Reichert all the way through.
Well, he's never forced with any reason to change.
That is true.
Just constantly himself all the time. But I think you possess your father's best qualities.
Yeah, and we have a lot in common. Like, obviously, our sense of humor, taste in music, a lot of stuff like that. Things that make us laugh, for sure.
And you're also both so undeniably yourselves. Like, you never try to be anyone else. You're always true to yourselves, and that's a very rare quality.
I never really thought about that, but yeah, maybe I got a good amount of that from my dad, because, he was always unapologetically... For better and worse.
Oh, yeah. He's completely unapologetic.
He's not putting on airs for anyone.
Every way else is wrong.
Yes, exactly. So, no, he is great. All right. Now, I don't think I forgot anything else. I got Tom Monda. Thanks for the theme song.
Thanks, brother.
That's it, folks. We'll see you all next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.